The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jory Slotkey for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Discover. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the double January-February 2021 issue. We begin with the story, The World's Biggest Polar Expedition. How thin ice and historically warm Arctic winter summers complicated Mosaic's $150 million hunt for climate data. Most of the crew aboard the RV Polar Stern icebreaker was asleep when the Arctic Ocean ice they were frozen into fully dissolved in late July. Researchers had called the ship home for 10 months, and this was not part of the plan. The team of pilots, climatologists, oceanographers, and others had deliberately frozen the ship into the ice floe north of Siberia in October 2019. Their mission? Drift for more than 365 days with the floe and surrounding sea ice to study the Arctic climate. With roughly 600 experts from around the globe and a cost topping $150 million, the multidisciplinary Drifting Observatory for the Study of Arctic Climate, or MOSAIC, is the biggest, most elaborate Arctic expedition ever. Our mission is to observe and understand the climate processes of the Arctic so we can represent them better in our climate models, says Marcus Rex, expedition leader and a scientist with Germany's Alfred Wegener Institute. The Arctic is warming three times faster than the global average, causing sea ice to shrivel and ultimately driving shifts in interactions between the ocean, ice, and atmosphere. At the same time, it's the region where we have the largest gaps in understanding of the climate system and where uncertainties in climate projections are largest, Rex says. Filling those gaps is important because what happens in the Arctic doesn't necessarily stay in the Arctic. Many experts say rapid change there also influences weather and climate throughout the Northern Hemisphere. MOSAIC set out to drift across a vast swath of the central Arctic. We wanted to track the influences on the ice throughout an entire year to help us understand how it grows and shrinks, how it moves and breaks, says Matthew Shoup, expedition co-coordinator and an atmospheric scientist at the University of Colorado Boulder. Although their flow broke up before the 12-month goal, Rex says the expedition has been a great success. More than 100 climate parameters were tracked and analyzed for nearly a full year. With so much data collected, it could take years to fully analyze. For Shoup, the magnitude of ice cracking was most surprising. Our camp had to be reorganized many times due to large fractures and then shearing movements, he says. These ice dynamics were particularly strong at the onset of spring 2020. Shoup's early interpretation is that during the summer of 2019, the warmest Arctic summer on record at that point, the sea ice was so thin that ponds forming on the surface melted through to the ocean below. In winter, those holes froze over along with other cracks in the ice. That made the ice weaker and prone to breaking when the team tried to conduct research out in the elements. People would break through into the ocean, but we were all wearing flotation and could get out quickly, Shoup says. For those that did, they typically had a hole named after them. The original plan was for the Polar Stern to be carried naturally past the North Pole during early spring, then near the southern edge of the Arctic sea ice cover in September. Instead, it reached the far edge by July, quickly spanning 1,050 miles due to unusual wind patterns and thin, faster-flowing ice. Upon the ship's arrival, warm temperatures and swells from the open ocean began threatening the researchers' flow and encampments on the ice. With fractures cutting through camp, the crew began moving everything aboard the ship on July 29th. We walked across cracked areas and hopped between different chunks of ice, Shoup says. When they went to bed on July 30th, the floe was still somewhat intact. By the next morning, all we could see was broken pieces of ice, floating in open water, Shoup says. Aboard the ship, the crew promptly migrated north in search of new ice. Finding less than expected, they headed straight for the North Pole itself. In just 6 days, on August 19th, they arrived. It was a notable moment, an icebreaker finding relatively scant ice at the North Pole. The Polar Stern eventually attached itself to a new floe to observe the autumn freeze-up. By mid-September, news came that Arctic sea ice had reached its second lowest level on record, and 2020 ranked the hottest summer ever recorded in the Northern Hemisphere. It's all part of the new Arctic we find ourselves in today, says crew member Julianne Strove, climatologist with the U.S. National Snow and Ice Data Center. One aspect of the rapidly transforming climate revealed itself in February, when a seal popped its head through a hole in the ice, not far from the North Pole. I didn't think they would live that far north, and especially in the dead of winter, Strove says. Dawn of the stem cell revolution? Researchers test more therapies with novel techniques for a range of diseases. For more than two decades, experts have prophesied that stem cells will someday revolutionize medicine. While adult stem cells have long been used to treat a handful of blood and immune disorders, the excitement has centered on two more versatile varieties, embryonic stem cells, or ESCs, and induced pluripotent stem cells, or iPSCs, both of which can be transformed into any cell type in the body. Google the promise of stem cells and you'll get at least 200,000 hits, involving ailments ranging from diabetes to neurodegenerative disorders. So far, however, no one has managed to translate that potential into a practical therapy. In 2020, a string of breakthroughs suggested that the revolution may finally be near. The most dramatic news came in May, when the New England Journal of Medicine published the first case report from a study using custom-grown stem cells to treat Parkinson's disease in humans. The debilitating condition, which affects 10 million people worldwide, primarily results from the loss of neurons that produce the neurotransmitter dopamine. Existing treatments have had limited success. Stem cell researchers aim to replace dying neurons with healthy ones grown in the lab, and the NEJM paper was the clearest sign yet that such efforts could pay off. The authors, led by neurosurgeon Jeffrey Schweitzer at Massachusetts General Hospital, and neurobiologist Kwang-Soo Kim at McLean Hospital, use what are known as autologous iPSCs. These are stem cells generated from the recipient's own mature cells, which greatly reduces the likelihood that immunosuppressants will be needed to prevent rejection. The team collected skin cells from a 69-year-old man and reprogrammed them into iPSCs. They then guided the stem cells to take on the characteristics of dopaminergic neurons, which they implanted into the patient's putamen, a brain region implicated in Parkinson's. Over a 12-month period, PET scan showed evidence that the new cells were functional. The man's motor symptoms and quality of life scores improved, while his daily medication requirement decreased. He experienced no side effects or complications. This represents a milestone in personalized medicine for Parkinson's, Kim wrote in a statement. It also represented a milestone for the patient, George Doc Lopez, a physician-turned medical equipment entrepreneur, whose financial contributions to Kim's research helped make the surgery possible. Once a record-breaking freediver, Lopez had severe tremors and rigidity before the implant. He could barely rise from a chair. Afterward, he was able to return to swimming and diving, and to perform such mundane tasks as tying his shoes. Parkinson's had me under a death sentence, he says. The therapy has changed not only my life, it has literally saved my life. Kim cautions that a single case study is only a beginning. More research, including full-scale, carefully controlled clinical trials, will be needed to establish the safety and efficacy of his team's technique. Nonetheless, he adds, I believe this study is extremely encouraging and informative. He and his colleagues plan to launch such a trial by the end of 2022. Meanwhile, other human studies using iPSCs or ESCs are planned or underway at a handful of medical centers around the globe. Stem cells also demonstrated life-saving powers for a six-day-old baby in Japan who received the world's first successful transplant of custom-grown liver cells. The child, whose sex has not been made public, was born with a urea cycle disorder, a genetic condition in which the liver is missing an enzyme that helps break down nitrogen into urea. Without it, ammonia builds up in the bloodstream with potentially fatal results. A liver transplant is usually needed, but it can't be performed until the child is several months old, which may be too late. Liver cells, called hepatocytes, can sometimes be transplanted as a bridge treatment, but supplies are scarce in Japan due to low rates of organ donorship. Doctors at the National Center for Child Health and Development use ESCs to grow hepatocytes, then injected 190 million of them into the baby's liver. In May, the team reported that the transplanted cells had kept blood ammonia levels normal for 6 months until the child received a liver transplant from its father. Some of this year's news was more controversial. In January, a team led by Osaka University surgeon Yoshiki Sawa reported having carried out the first successful transplant of iPSC-derived cardiomyocytes, heart muscle cells, in a human patient. The recipient, who had cardiac muscle damage from a blocked artery, was implanted with a biodegradable sheet holding 100 million of the cells as part of a small clinical trial. The researchers, who used allogenic iPSCs derived from a donor's cells, plan to monitor the patient over the next year and eventually try the procedure on nine more participants. In May, however, a Chinese surgeon disputed that Sawa was the first to perform such a transplant. Wang Dongjin of Nanjing Drum Tower Hospital told the journal Nature that his team had implanted two men with cardiomyocytes derived from allogenic iPSCs a full year earlier. One patient, a 55-year-old electrician, said that before the surgery, he was constantly tired and out of breath. Now, he could take a walk, use stairs, and sleep for an entire night. Aside from which team won the race, both experiments leave big question marks. Although animal studies have shown promising results for iPSC-derived cardiomyocytes, Sawa doesn't think implanted cells integrate with the recipient's heart tissue. Instead, he speculates, they may stimulate healing by releasing growth factors. If that's the case, Sawa's critics say, it would be safer to identify those regenerative proteins and administer them in a less risky way, like injection. Wang's experiment was muddied by the fact that both patients received heart bypass surgery along with their new cells. As University of Washington pathologist Charles Murray noted in Nature, if you do two things to somebody and they get better, you can't say which one caused it. Did COVID heal nature? A global shutdown seemed to turn over city streets and supposedly canals to wildlife. Ecologists saw something deeper. The Welsh village of Llandudno went quiet in March as stay-at-home orders began. Then the goats descended from the mountain. A wild herd of Kashmiri goats has lived near Llandudno for almost two centuries, and they sometimes come down from the Great Orme Mountain during inclement weather. But this spring, while the human world hit pause, they settled into town for a few days, munching on hedges and trotting down the empty streets. The goats joined a host of animal celebrities flooding the internet after they supposedly reclaimed urban areas. Dolphins frolicking in Venice's clean canals. Elephants drunk on corn wine in a tea garden in China's Yunnan province. Tweets announcing these events proclaimed that nature was recovering from years of abuse by humans thanks to COVID-19 shutdowns. While the goats really did come to Llandudno, Many of the other reports were false or exaggerated. The Venetian dolphins were actually in Sardinia, hundreds of miles from Venice. It's not clear where and when those elephant photos were taken, but they don't seem to be linked to COVID shutdowns, nor pachyderm debauchery. It all begs the question, did COVID really heal nature? It's much more complicated than that, says Seth Magel, ecologist and director of the Urban Wildlife Institute at Chicago's Lincoln Park Zoo. This pandemic seems very long to us in the span of our lives, but from an evolutionary ecological standpoint, it's really the blink of an eye. Sparrows in San Francisco did, in fact, change their song during lockdown, according to a September study in Science. But it could be months or years before we have extensive data about the overall effects of the pandemic on wildlife, says Chris Schell, an urban ecologist at the University of Washington, Tacoma. We're sort of living through the experiment. So far, Magel says, there's some anecdotal evidence of changes in animal behavior. Raccoons are naturally active at dawn and dusk, but when people are around, they sometimes shift to night hours. Magel heard reports that with fewer people out during quarantine, raccoons moved away from the graveyard shift and started coming out at night. At twilight, he also suspects that some animals might have ventured into urban areas not to reclaim their historical territory, but because more humans ventured into animal habitat to combat cabin fever. I actually think some of our natural spaces are maybe being used more by humans, which may push animals more into urban landscapes. While the scientific jury is still out, stories and social media can convince us that animals were bolder during the lockdown. Perhaps bird numbers in your yard seemed extraordinary, but Magel cautions it might just have been that we're watching. Maybe that cardinal always comes to your house at 11 a.m. You're just home now, so you see it, he says. Animal behavior isn't the only change people noticed. In some cities, the reduction of traffic made the air cleaner. This spring saw a 17% dip in CO2 emissions as people stayed home and didn't drive. The problem is that one spring is barely a drop in the bucket in terms of affecting the planet's climate in the long run, says Corinne LeQuaire, a climate scientist at the University of East Anglia, who published a paper on the phenomenon in Nature. Although this is a really steep decrease in emissions, never seen before, as far as we can tell, she says, this drop in emissions does nothing to slow down climate change. That's because humans have pumped billions of tons of CO2 into our atmosphere for decades. A few months of reduced driving aren't enough to fix that. Substantial change would require long-term shifts in policy and industry. You can't tackle climate change with behavior change alone, LeQuaire says. You need behavior change, and you need people to accept new technology and encourage them to embrace it. That, she says, means tackling climate change needs to be led by governments. Shell views this moment like going to the hospital for a minor injury and finding out that you have a serious underlying heart condition. Noticing how the air is cleaner and the animals are bolder when people stay home reveals the bigger structural changes we need to make. That includes social changes, too. COVID wasn't necessarily the elixir that healed or is healing nature, Shell says, but it did draw our attention to the ways humans affect the environment. What happens in society feeds back into ecology. Similarly, inequity and systemic racism for many years have created environmental mosaics of inequality, pockets of greater ecological harm in poorer and more marginalized communities. If we're going to see sustained healing, like legitimate healing, it's not going to be right away, he says. The spring of 2020 gave us a valuable glimpse of what life would be like if we made systemic changes to help the environment long term. I hope that's something that we really will carry forward after this pandemic is behind us, says Magel. This idea that, yes, we need animals in our neighborhoods. It makes us feel good to watch them, and it gives us the sense that we live in places that are kind of wild and kind of unexpected, and that can surprise us in a really positive way. Black in academia. How far have we come, and how far do we still have to go? In May, the killing of George Floyd brought a harsh reality to the forefront of conversations worldwide. Racism permeates every aspect of society, and science, as part of society and my own profession, is not immune. Social media movements in 2020, such as hashtag Black in the Ivory and hashtag Black Birders Week, urged the scientific community to take a hard look at the racism that lies within its walls, as revealed by its own community members. Thousands of Black scientists took to Twitter, Facebook, and beyond to share personal stories of prejudice, stereotyping, and discrimination faced throughout their careers. These experiences have had devastating consequences for their mental health, professional success, and ultimately, willingness to stay in their fields. Racism in science is nothing new. For centuries, science has been a foremost tool used to build, defend, and maintain racial inequality. As the transatlantic slave trade reached its peak, the 18th century saw the emergence of so-called race sciences. European scientists and philosophers debated the number and characteristics of human races, typically depicting Black people as predisposed to unintelligence, laziness, and criminality. This work continued in the 19th century with the American eugenics movement, as scientists argued for the genetic superiority of those classified as white. Even as science began to understand race as socially constructed rather than biologically determined, several scholars began to advance notions of Black Americans' cultural inferiority. Recent decades brought little change. In the 1990s, social scientists continued to argue that genetic unintelligence, or a culture of poverty, keeps Black Americans from success, blaming academic and family shortcomings while overlooking the roles of history and discrimination. Today, scholars across the sciences uncover racial disparities in all areas of life, often without explaining the myriad social factors that drive such differences. One example lies in the well-publicized finding that, as of August 18th, Black people were over twice as likely to die from COVID-19 as white people are. There's less talk, however, of the structural factors that cause such disparities, and even less of how to fix them. Throughout 2020, scientific institutions, including my alma mater, Princeton, began to change the names of graduate schools, research journals, and awards that used offensive terminology or honored figures who held racist views. Statues came down on some campuses, and several published papers, some in renowned journals, were retracted for flaws that promote harmful stereotypes or downplay racial inequalities. Broader research, however, suggests racial problems run much deeper than monikers and symbols. As a social psychologist, I study how racial inequalities manifest in social interactions. In a 2019 paper, I compared how white people speak when interacting with Black people. Somewhat counterintuitively, I found that white liberals, including Democratic presidential candidates, engage in what I call a competence downshift. They use fewer words highlighting their own competence, like assertive or competitive, when talking to a Black person or a mostly minority audience. White conservatives, who research suggests are generally less interested in getting along with racial minorities, showed no such shift. This likely well-meaning, if ultimately patronizing phenomenon may be one of the many that makes scientists of color in mostly white, outwardly progressive scientific communities feel unwelcome. This competence downshift is likely rooted in the very stereotypes that science has propagated for centuries, those depicting Black people as lower in status and ability. These ideas are alive and well. In another study, my team and I found that white and Black adults nationwide associate white and Black people with high versus low status jobs, respectively. For instance, participants guessed that a white person might be a doctor or lawyer, while a Black person might be a maintenance worker. These race status associations significantly predicted bias, hiring discrimination, and opposition to policies for racial equality. The stereotypes also play out in day-to-day interactions for scientists, such as when a Black professor is talked down to or mistaken for the janitor, leaving them feeling unsure of themselves and unwelcome. All of this can deter Black people from entering or staying in the sciences. In our rapidly diversifying world, the lack of scientists of color becomes increasingly harmful to humanity. Researchers of color are less subject to racial ignorance, allowing them to conduct research that is meaningful to more communities. Journal editors of color are often more likely to spot harmful implications that research might have for vulnerable communities, while participants of color allow scientific breakthroughs that apply to the many rather than to the few. As Black Lives Matter protests surged this past summer, organizations scrambled to release statements of solidarity. Conversations around reforming racial justice, education, housing, and the economy came to the forefront. The substance of such reforms will hinge on science, the tool the world turns to for addressing its most pressing problems. To be effective and inclusive, science, too, needs sweeping reforms, increasing the number of scientists of color, improving their sense of belonging within their chosen fields, and rebuilding eroded trust between academia and communities of color. As the world grapples with racism, one can only hope that this time, science rises to the challenge. New hope in fighting food allergies. FDA's okay of first drug signals more treatments to come. An estimated 32 million Americans have food allergies, nearly 10% of the population, and 10 times the prevalence reported just three decades ago. Among children, emergency room visits for the severe, potentially life-threatening reaction known as anaphylaxis are skyrocketing. But new hope arose in January when the Food and Drug Administration approved Palforzia, the first drug designed to desensitize patients to an allergenic foodstuff, specifically peanuts. The medication, approved for kids aged 4 to 17, consists of a standardized dose of powdered peanut protein, which can be mixed into snacks like pudding or applesauce. Over time, patients receive increasing amounts until they can tolerate the equivalent of two peanuts without serious symptoms. Palforzia isn't perfect. It's expensive. The list price is $890 a month. It must be taken indefinitely. Boosts in dosage must be administered in a medical setting, and some children react too strongly to continue the therapy. But clinical trials found that it worked for about two-thirds of patients. Plus, it could provide a model for drugs aimed at allergies to other foods. Meanwhile, research that could lead to better food allergy treatments is making major strides. Over the past 5 years or so, scientists have found growing evidence that food allergies result from imbalances in the gut microbiome, probably tied to a mix of environmental, lifestyle, dietary, and genetic influences. Repairing these underlying biochemical glitches could be more effective than desensitizing patients to individual allergens. We've run out of time for today's episode of Discover. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jory Slodke, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Discover is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call area code 919-832-5138. That number again is area code 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.